Juana and I are very happy to be here. This is great. I've never been in Philadelphia in my whole life, so this is really neat. Joanna has, but and we just first of all, I want to thank the brethren here for having us here, and thank our gracious hostess, Sister Rachel Grice, and our host, young Aaron Grice. They have been most hospitable towards us. Appreciate it. And yesterday we had some brethren over to Len and Gretchen's home, and fellowship was just wonderful. We're just excited. This has been great. This has been great. I will bring you the love and greetings of our little class in Seattle, and especially from my sister in the flesh, Sister Lori Flynn, and my mom, who is many of you have asked about mom. I'll tell you in a sec, but she's back in Bremerton, and she sends her love to you all. Sister Lisi Fries, who is Byron Keith's mother, and she's in our class, but kind of like my mom, not able to get to the meetings. But we see her often, and she wanted her special love sent to you all. And of course, my mother-in-law, Sister Marge Hagensick, and sister-in-law, Sister Sherelle Hagensick, all send their love to you. As I said, many of you have asked about mom. You've seen some reports. Mom has been, since the Boise Convention, April 29th, she's been in the hospital, oh my goodness, I don't know, 22 or 23 days or something, and that's in four separate trips. About 2 weeks ago, in Portland, at the hospital there, I was told one day that I should start preparing a funeral because mom had 1 or 2 days. And okay. So they unplugged everything, and 3 days later, they said, she needs to go home. She's doing fine. So she wasn't really doing fine, but she ended up in the hospital again, back up in Bremerton. But she's been in for the last 10 days now, in a skilled nursing care facility in Bremerton, and we'll see how that goes. But she is doing so much better than like 2 or 3 weeks ago. Oh my goodness. So it's good to kind of have the old Sister Beverly back with us. And a quick invite to all of you. We have a convention way over on the west side of the country. We're about as close to the Pacific Ocean as we are here to the Atlantic Ocean. And but it's still in the continental United States, believe me. But we will be having our 72nd annual convention this Labor Day weekend. And I know there's some other wonderful conventions that weekend, some of them very close here. But if you want to change of pace or you need to go out west and see what it's like, you will receive a warm welcome. The way of holiness. This is an expression. It's very familiar to Bible students. Hopefully you can see the screen better with that. But this expression is very familiar to Bible students. And I would venture to say that the vast majority of us could quote Isaiah 35:8 completely and give chapter and verse as well. The entire chapter, Isaiah 35, is indeed the great kingdom on earth chapter in the Bible. And I would also venture to say that the great majority of us have used all or at least part of Isaiah 35 when witnessing. It's central to our faith. The whole chapter gives some specifics about the ransom and especially about restitution, concepts that are misunderstood by so many. But to us, it's thrilling to think on these things in Isaiah 35, which are promised to the whole world, not to Christians exclusively. Now, we usually abbreviate the first part of Isaiah 35:8 and say, the highway of holiness. And I think that's okay, as long as we don't lose any of the meaning that is set forth in the words, and an highway shall be there, and a way, and it shall be called the way of holiness. The unclean shall not pass over it, but it shall be for those, the wayfaring men, though fools, shall not err therein. And we're going to get back to that in about a half an hour or so. We're going to approach the subject today in maybe a little different way. We want to see how this phrase, the way of holiness, fits into the context to see if we can extract the full meaning of it And we don't have time to get into every little contextual detail, but this will be a fairly in-depth study. I'm going to start by reading a quote from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown commentary about Isaiah chapters 34 and 35. This thing is acting up this morning. There we go. So, quote, the 34th and 35th chapters form one prophecy, end quote. Now, I've not found that anywhere else, but when you look at the chapters 33 through 36, it seems to be fairly accurate. Chapter 33 is about King Sennacherib of Assyria dealing treacherously with Israel and Judah, and then God dealing treacherously with Assyria. Then sort of sandwiched in between chapters 33 and 36 are chapters 34 and 35, which, as we will see, have nothing to do with Assyria or its king. Chapter 36, then, gets back to a history lesson about Hezekiah, the king of Judah, and the problems he was having with the Assyrians. Chapters 34 and 35 seem to be one complete prophecy of the blessings of the kingdom and what precedes them. And they don't seem to relate in any way to chapters 33 and 36. Anyway, I found this way of looking at it very helpful in trying to extract lessons and exact meanings to our subject, the way of holiness. So we're going to treat Isaiah 34 and 35 as one chapter, as one complete prophecy. Let's see what happens. In Isaiah 34, there are some really graphic depictions of God's wrath and indignation. God tells the nation in verses 1 and 2 to come near and to hearken. He tells them his indignation is upon all nations. God said, "Let the earth hear." So we understand from the very beginning that symbolism will be used because the word earth here means land. And, of course, the land cannot hear. It appears to me that the first part of this chapter is saying that all the horrible things that are going to soon be described will be all-inclusive. The whole world, every nation, from every part of the land will be affected. God's fury is on the armies, and he will utterly destroy them. Their carcasses will stink, and more symbolism. The mountains or governments shall be melted by blood. Verse 4 says, "And all the host of heaven shall be dissolved." And what is interesting about the word host in verse 4 is that it is the same word that is translated armies in verse 2. Now, whether one translates the word in verse 4, host or army, it is still a clue that this is not the literal heaven, but is symbolic of something else. We know this because the angelic hosts of heaven are not going to dissolve. They have eternal life. And we also know that if there were literal armies in heaven, they would be the ones exacting the Lord's indignation on the nations. They would not be the ones getting dissolved. So, what does this represent? Brother Russell tells us in Volume 4, pages 551 and 2, and other places, that the heavens are the ecclesiastical heavens, the nominal church. Now, this seems very reasonable since we know that it cannot mean the real heaven. And haven't we learned from history that the literal armies of papacy are no longer with us? This is just one step toward the ultimate and total demise of that system. Chapter 34, verse 6 says, "The Lord hath a sacrifice in Bozrah and a great slaughter in the land of Idumea," or Edom. This text continues the thought of ecclesiastical heavens. And Brother Russell has some good comments on this in Volume 4, pages 16 and 17. And I will quickly paraphrase. He says that the sacrifice of the lambs is the tribulation of the saints, and that the goats represent the tare class. Edom here represents the Babylon of Revelation, which, like Esau, sold their birthright for peculiar advantage. Now, the true church is lumped in with Christendom from the world's perspective. Perhaps that is why they are shown as sacrificing in Bozra, which, according to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown again, was a chief city or place of the Edomites and signifies a fortress, being no doubt a place well fortified. And doesn't that sound like the situation of the true church? The true church sacrifices while in the world and surrounded by Christendom. They live lives of sacrifice while being called the sons of God. That would indeed be a chief place. And the true church is fortified with the Holy Spirit from the forces of Christendom. However, it sounds almost like the true church will be destroyed with the rest of the nations in Babylon. But instead, we think the thought here is that there will be a time when the sacrificing would be done. It is for a time, for an age. It's not forever. And the timing corresponds closely to the destruction of the false church described in verses 9 through 17. From verse 9 to the end of chapter 34, a dismal scene is described. And the streams thereof shall be turned into pitch, and the dust thereof into brimstone, and the land thereof shall become a burning pitch. Well, that sounds like no living thing could survive there. But, starting in verse 11, we are introduced to a variety of animals which do live in this symbolic environment. The birds mentioned are the cormorant, better translated pelican, the owl, the raven, the screech owl, the great owl, and the vulture, and every one shall be with her mate. Why are these birds named? Well, we're going to take a brief look at these birds to see if we can find an answer. If you're to look at Leviticus chapter 11, verses 11 through 19, you will find a list of all the birds or fowl that were an abomination to the Lord and that the Israelites were expressly forbidden to eat. These fowl were considered unclean. Common denominator, all of these birds were birds of prey. And even the swan in Leviticus 11:18, which is Strong's number 8580, literally means an unclean bird. Birds of prey were not to be used for food in Israel. There is one bird that is mentioned that we need to talk about a little bit. In verse 14, we find the screech owl. And normally we would say, okay, a bird of prey, unclean. But the word that is translated screech owl is Strong's number 3917, and it means a night specter. And the online Bible lexicon says it means Lilith, name of a female goddess known as a night demon who haunts the desolate places of Edom. And secondly, might be a nocturnal animal that inhabits desolate places. And the Companion Bible says that charms are used against it today in Palestine. A suggestion would be that this shows that the fallen angels have been involved closely with Babylon while they were held in chains of darkness unto judgment and will eventually be destroyed as well. And so we see in Isaiah chapter 34 that the list of birds consists of unclean birds. And that really fits the picture of the destruction of evil. Whatever these birds represent, they are unclean and an abomination to God. I think this point would really hit home with any Jews who read this prophecy. There is also, indirectly, another clue about what Idumea or Edom represents. Brother Russell tells us, again, volume 4, page 17, the symbolic Edom of Isaiah's prophecy corresponds to the symbolic Babylon of Revelation, as all the land of Edom symbolizes all of Christendom. And look what we find in Revelation 18, verse 2. And he cried out with a mighty voice, saying, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She has become a dwelling place of demons and a prison of every unclean spirit and a prison of every unclean and hateful bird." There are some animals mentioned as well in chapter 34. We find unicorns and the bittern, which is a hedgehog or porcupine, neither of which is a clean animal. We also find dragons and wild beasts of the desert and wild beasts of the island and the satyr. What are they? Well, the unicorn is a reem. It's the Hebrew word for a certain wild bull called the oryx, which is now extinct. The oryx was a huge predecessor of modern cattle. It was eventually domesticated in a few areas, but the wild ones were hunted aggressively. The last known oryx died in Poland in 1627. Since they are predecessors of cattle, they were bovines, and they must have chewed their cud and had cloven hooves. The Israelites knew them as wild beasts, but they would have been considered clean. And here's a question for you. Why is this clean animal listed with all the unclean birds and beasts in Isaiah 34? Well, there may be some added pictures of Babylon here. We know that the unclean birds and beasts represent the evil in Babylon. We also know that there were true believers around at that time, perhaps pictured by the oryx. Both were hunted down and killed. The saints would have been hunted to extinction by the papacy if God would have allowed it. Isaiah may have chosen to use the oryx in his prophecy in Isaiah 34 rather than the domesticated bullock, because from Babylon's point of view, the rebellious true saints must have seemed like the wild oryx and ripe for killing. Dragons are mentioned in the King James Version. The Hebrew word here is tanin, and it means a land or sea monster. Several other versions translate it jackal. Jackals are not on the clean list in Leviticus 11, and they eat carrion, so of course an unclean animal. The wild beasts of the desert and the wild beasts of the island are just that, wild beasts. Some commentaries refer to them as monstrous ones or wildcats. Neither of these is on the clean list. And finally, the satyr. The word literally means he-goat, but has become associated with demon-possessed goats. And this would tie in nicely with the thoughts of the aforementioned screech owl being a night demon and representing the fallen angels working in Babylon. There are a few other noteworthy things in Isaiah 34. Verse 15 says, "There shall the great owl make her nest, and lay, and hatch, and gather under her shadow. There shall the vultures also be gathered, every one with her mate." This might suggest that these unclean and beastly animals are going to continue in this place forever. Verse 17 says, "They shall possess it forever. From generation to generation shall they dwell therein." Now think about this. We have a picture here which says in verses 9 and 10, "And the streams thereof shall be turned into pitch, and the dust thereof into brimstone, and the land thereof shall become burning pitch. It shall not be quenched night nor day. The smoke thereof shall go up forever. From generation to generation it shall lie waste." Brethren, could we have been wrong all these years? Could this be a picture of everlasting torture in a fiery place for non-Christians symbolized by these unclean birds and animals? Well, of course not. Even though we just read in verse 17 that they shall possess it forever, that can't possibly be what it means. One thing that will help us here is looking into the meaning of the word possess. According to the online Bible lexicon, it means to seize, dispossess, take possession of, or inherit, among other related definitions. Now, we've talked about the heavens and Idumea or Edom representing the ecclesiastical heavens, and that they are the same as Babylon the Great, and that they all represent the great apostate church. And what did Babylon do with the true church? Babylon seized it, it dispossessed it, and they took possession of it. And they will inherit utter destruction. And what did we note about Babylon in Revelation 18:2? It became the habitation of devils, the hold of every foul spirit, and the cage of every unclean and hateful bird. We strongly suggest that the vile and unclean animals and birds in Isaiah 34 represent all that is evil in Babylon and what must be destroyed. The false, God-dishonoring doctrines, the fornication with civil governments, and so forth. You see, this is what is to be utterly destroyed. It is not the definition of what the destruction is. It does not picture bad people in a place called hell forever. Now, before we continue, I would like you to think about one or two words that would describe the scene in chapter 34 of Isaiah, especially from verse 9 on. Okay, very good. We're thinking. That's good. Now, all of us have different words in mind, but I have a hunch that many of you thought of the same word that I did. Wilderness. Don't you think that's a good description of that awful place? How about desert, or in two words, maybe a solitary place? Whatever word we chose, I think you will agree we would not want to live there. So let's continue on and read chapter 35, verse 1. The wilderness and the solitary place shall be glad, and the desert shall rejoice and blossom as the rose. Now wait a minute. Is this wilderness down the street from the one just described in chapter 34? How could it be? It has to be referring to the wilderness just described in chapter 34. Otherwise, it becomes nonsensical. Isaiah is clearly telling us that the awful place he just described has changed. And then he proceeds to contrast the changes in chapter 35. The wilderness has become new, and it is clear that the previous wilderness will be gone, utterly destroyed. You might say there will be a new heaven and a new earth. What a wonderful promise. So how does that square with Isaiah 34:10? It shall not be quenched night nor day. The smoke thereof shall go up forever from generation to generation. It shall lie waste, referring to the brimstone and burning pitch in verse 9, or from generation to generation in verse 17. Chapter 34, verse 2 says, "For the indignation of the Lord is upon all nations, and his fury is upon all their armies. He hath utterly destroyed them. He hath delivered them to the slaughter." The words utterly destroyed truly mean just that. This means that the nations will come to an end as we know them now. And when an army is utterly destroyed, does that mean that everyone in that army is killed? Micah 4 helps us with that question. Verses 1 and 2 say, "The mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established in the top of the mountains, and it shall be exalted above the hills, and the people shall flow unto it. And many nations shall come and say, Come and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord." By doing this, the nations will become one kingdom with Christ and his bride reigning. Micah 4, verse 3 says, "And they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up a sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more." No war, no armies. But the people that had been in those armies will be there, and they will be doing peaceful things. Hence, the armies will be destroyed utterly, not the people in them. So we see the connector of chapters 34 and 35 is the wilderness, solitary place, and desert, described so graphically in chapter 34. These will be gone, and it will be replaced by the gladness, peacefulness, beauty and rejoicing found in chapter 35. Let's take a look at some of those joyous new things and see how they contrast with chapter 34. Chapter 35, verse 1 says, "The solitary place shall be glad." And the words "for them" having been added in the King James Version. The words "solitary place" literally mean a dry place, like a desert. It will be glad because it is made new. Quite a difference from the burning pitch and brimstone in Idumea found in chapter 34, verse 9. Verse 2 of Isaiah 35 says, "The glory of Lebanon shall be given unto it." What is the glory of Lebanon? Lebanon is a mountainous region. The winter snowpack serves as a reservoir for the drier growing season. And there's two main rivers that flow through the area with smaller streams as well. But it's a far cry from the brimstone desert found in chapter 34, verse 9. The fertile mountain soil and abundance of water make for lush gardens, picturing plenty of food in the kingdom with every man sitting under his own vine and fig tree. And, of course, Lebanon was known for its trees, especially the cedars. And according to various articles I read, Lebanon seems to be the only Middle Eastern country without a desert, although it does have some arid places. All in all, Lebanon seems to be not showing up on my screen. Lebanon seems to be a good picture of the mountain of the house of the Lord found in Micah 4, verse 1, which is the kingdom. Lush and green, with a pure river of water of life running through it, and the tree of life, with its leaves for healing and its fruit for eating, standing firm. The promises continue in verses 3 and 4. "Strengthen ye the weak hands and confirm the feeble knees. Say to them that are of a fearful heart, be strong and fear not." Now contrast that with the fear that the host of heaven, Idumea, ruled with for hundreds of years. In Isaiah 34, verse 8, we get a little hint of a promise amid all the destruction and evil described in that chapter. "For the Lord has a day of vengeance, a year of recompense for the cause of Zion." God's vengeance is utterly destroying the nations and the false church. Again, not the people, but the systems. But then he mentions a year of recompense. The word recompense here can mean either requital or reward. And the word requital can mean either reward or retaliation. And from the context, we believe that the word recompense here means reward. And stick with me here. The whole phrase reads, "recompense for the cause of Zion." Well, what is the cause of Zion? For Bible students, that's an easy question, isn't it? The cause of Zion is what we find in Isaiah 35. Wonderful promises to the world about a kingdom on earth. The blessing of all the families of the earth. Now, did these people on earth do something to deserve such a reward? Heavens, no. Jesus did something so that they could receive the promises. Part of God's vengeance was that they lived in a world ruled by Satan and then died. And of course, God's vengeance really gets hot right before the kingdom in a great time of trouble. And look what we find in chapter 35, verse 4. "Your God will come with a vengeance, even God with a recompense. He will come and save you." God's vengeance will be over. His reward is a resurrection to the scene described in chapter 35. What will he save them from? All the horrible things described in chapter 34. And aren't you glad you know that? Praise the Lord. Chapter 35, verse 5 says, "Then the eyes of the blind shall be opened, and the ears of the deaf shall be unstopped." It seems logical from the context of chapter 34 that this not only refers to physical blindness and deafness, but spiritual blindness and spiritual deafness as well. The awful scenes described in chapter 34, verses 9 through 17, are about the wickedness and uncleanness of Babylon. The masses were blinded to the message of salvation for all. They just could not hear that message. And that all changes in chapter 35. What a contrast. Chapter 35, verse 6 says, "Then shall the lame man leap as in hart, and the tongue of the dumb sing, for in the wilderness shall waters break out, and streams in the desert." What a wonderful time that will be. Again, we believe that this not only applies to literal water, but the waters of truth. Chapter 34, verse 9, talks about streams turning to pitch. In the false system, there has been almost no water of truth. Not so in the kingdom. Verses 6 and 7 talk more about the dry land becoming streams, pools, and springs. You know, the truth will abound in the kingdom. And the last part of verse 7 reads, In the haunt of jackals, its resting place, grass becomes reeds and rushes. The word jackal here is the same word translated dragon in chapter 34, verse 13. Now, as I understand it, a large majority of jackals live in deserts, savannas, and arid grasslands. The jackals in chapter 34, verse 13, are in the desolate desert area described in the last half of that chapter. However, in the kingdom, pictured in chapter 35, jackals are said to reside in areas of grass, reeds, and rushes. Reeds and rushes are water plants and clearly implies that they will be close to the water of truth. You may remember, too, that they are unclean animals. And the picture may be that since they will then be living so close to the water of, so close to the truth and drinking of it freely, that the Lord will allow them to clean up in the kingdom. And, of course, we know that the water of life mentioned in Revelation 22 will be for all mankind, regardless of how unclean their lives were and how unclean their hearts had been in the previous age. Everyone will have the chance to clean up, so to speak. Verse 8 of chapter 35 reads this way, "And an highway shall be there, and a way, and it shall be called the way of holiness. The unclean shall not pass over it, but it shall be for those, the wayfaring men, though fools shall not err therein." And you thought we weren't going to make it back to verse 8, didn't you? We're going to dissect this promise to see what we can find out. The word highway here is Strong's number 4547, and it means, according to the professor, a thoroughfare. Whereas the word way is number 1870, and it means a road as trodden, figuratively a course of life or mode of action. Thoroughfare is defined in dictionary.com this way, a road from one place to another, especially a main road, a way through or access. And I think these definitions are all apropos to our subject. The picture in Isaiah 35 is of the kingdom. There will be something there that will get a person from a bad place to a good place. Where are they going and where did they come from? Well, that's pretty simple, isn't it? Every human being, when resurrected in the kingdom, will have come from a state of sin. And if they choose, they will go to a state of human perfection. That will be a major journey for them. Is there some sort of vehicle on this highway that will get them there? We think there is, and it's called the New Covenant. And I like Brother Russell's thoughts on this. He says in reprint 4575, "Thus the highway of holiness will be opened up through Israel, through the ancient worthies, through the New Covenant made with them. The highway of holiness will lead from imperfection to perfection, justification, restitution of all that was lost in Adam and redeemed at Calvary." Now, Remember, the word way means figuratively a course of life or mode of action. The text says that an highway shall be there and a way called the way of holiness. Now, I remember when I first came into the truth, and I thought this was kind of like doublespeak. What was the difference between the highway and the way? And I chalked it up to repetition for emphasis. And then I finally learned what I'm sure you all know. There are two parts to the way of holiness. First, there is the vehicle that takes you where you are going in the kingdom. It is the new covenant. And that is God's part. The second part is each person's part. The way, the course of life, or mode of action which each person chooses for themselves. You see, it's still not a totally free ride. God isn't going to put everyone in the new covenant arrangement and then send them off on the highway and have them just sail through to perfection. No, we know better than that. Each person will have to choose his course of life, his mode of action. God is not going to force anyone to accept the terms of the new covenant. But each person will be responsible for learning God's ways, God's course of life, God's mode of action, and taking those ways into their own hearts if they want to attain perfection. And this is brought clearly to our attention, of course, in Jeremiah 31, 29 through 31. In those days they shall say no more that the fathers have eaten a sour grape and the children's teeth are set on edge. But everyone shall die for his own iniquity. Every man that eateth the sour grape, his teeth shall be set on edge. Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. Now, the next part of Isaiah 35 was confusing to me for a long time. It says in the King James Version, the unclean shall not pass over it. The unclean shall not pass over it. Unless I'm mistaken, isn't everyone who will be resurrected to the earth unclean? Isn't that what the kingdom is for? To clean them up? We think it might be. So how do we harmonize that? Well, the words pass over are Strong's number 5674, and they mean to cross over, used very widely of any transition, literally or figuratively. When one crosses over something, it means they go all the way over, not just part way. They transition from one place to another. And here's an example of how that word is used. Genesis 31:21 says, he rose up and passed over the river. Now we know from the context that Jacob made it all the way over to the other side. He made the transition. He didn't get part way and then drown. And so it is in the kingdom. But if one does not clean up, so to speak, one will not pass all the way over to human perfection. However, everyone who starts out on the way of holiness starts out as unclean. The way of holiness is the cleaning up process. Now, the next part of the text used to really get me wondering. But it shall be for those, the wayfaring men, though fools, shall not err therein. Huh? However, I did not feel alone after I started researching other translations. Even the translators must have had a little difficulty with this because the renderings are kind of all over the board. I did find two translations that seem to catch the thought that Micah gives us in chapter 4, verses 2 and 3. And he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For the law shall go forth of Zion, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem, and he shall judge among many people. Put very simply, God does not need to teach those that already know, and God does not judge those who have not had the opportunity to learn, those who might be termed fools. So here are my two favorite translations of Isaiah 35:8, from the Tanakh. And a highway shall appear there, which shall be called the Sacred Way. No one unclean shall pass along it, but it shall be for them. No traveler, not even fools, shall go astray. And from the Leisure translation, and there shall be an highway and a way, and the way and the holy way it shall be called. No unclean one shall pass over it, but it shall be only theirs. The wayfaring man and those unacquainted therewith shall not go astray. Don't those translations make this a little clearer? They kind of do for me. The way of holiness is for the unclean. It's for the fools. And if they change their mode of action from what it was in the previous age, as they travel and accept God's arrangements, they will pass over or transition to human perfection. And what a wonderful contrast that is to the scenario in Isaiah 34. Pretty much all the obstacles that have hindered mankind from coming into a relationship with God, pictured in 34, will be gone. Isaiah 62:10 says, go through the gates, clear the way for the people, build up the highway, remove the stones, lift up the standard over the peoples. 3 minutes. Okay. The parched land, devoid of truth, will be streams of living waters. Satan will be bound. The Holy Spirit will be poured out on all mankind. Physical ailments will be eliminated. It will indeed be a sacred way, a way of holiness. The only remaining stumbling block will be the flesh itself. Verse 9 continues that theme of no obstacles. No lion shall be there, nor any ravenous beast shall go up thereon. It shall not be found there. Now, the lion here has to represent Satan. I mean, it just has to. And isn't Satan mankind's biggest obstacle in this age? He will be bound. And the ravenous beast could represent the beast in Revelation. That system, so graphically portrayed in Isaiah 34, will have been utterly destroyed. The unclean practices like indulgences, gone. The unclean doctrines of Babylon will be gone. And the water-starved masses will drink freely the pure water of truth, which brings forth lush fruit, fruit of the Spirit, and beauty of character, graces of the Spirit, as symbolized in chapter 35. And, unlike Babylon, they shall neither hurt nor destroy in all God's holy mountain. And volume 1, page 217, gives a list of other things that are stumbling blocks or stumbling stones now, but will be removed from the way of holiness. And just who is it that will be in this glorious way of holiness? Chapter 35, verse 9 and 10. The redeemed shall walk there, and the ransomed of the Lord shall return. Everyone who has ever lived shall have the opportunity. And what will they do on that way of holiness? They will come to Zion with songs of everlasting joy upon their heads. And what will be the ultimate result of passing over the way of holiness? They shall obtain joy and gladness, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away. May thy kingdom come, and thy will be done in earth, even as it is done in heaven. And may the Lord add his blessing.